Greetings, all you 99%ers. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. Okay, today, U.S. economy, QE2 in the U.K., more stimulus. Japan, weakest link in the global economy. Of course, Europe and the U.K. are rapidly catching up in that category. And we see the same-o going on with global central banks, pumping more and more liquidity into the global economy in a false hope that somehow that will stimulate recovery. And then we have this apparent anomaly of the U.S. economy, which everyone says is doing so great. Well, we had the jobs report this morning, and you would think, things are looking better on the job front. But as I've been saying many times, I'm not going to go into it. Those job statistics and that volatility in job statistics is disturbing, just as the volatility in the U.S. economy is disturbing, suggesting either we have some statistical problems with seasonality adjustment, now that the labor force has changed so dramatically, we have so much long-term participation rate decline, over 10 million people leaving the labor force, and we have so much contingent work, temporary part-time work. We have a decline in full-time jobs, full-time equivalent jobs going on. We have the gig economy. I think all of these dramatic, significant changes have screwed up their ability to really estimate employment. And I'm not going to go into that. I've talked about that to some degree already. But I do want to talk about something related in U.S. economy, and that is this apparent anomaly that all the indicators are flashing red, in other words, declining or stagnating in the U.S. economy, but consumer spending seems to be going. How do we explain this? How can everything be in a downturn and yet consumer spending going up? There was an interesting interview this morning by Bill Gross, who is one of the experts in global bond, big billionaire, and runs billionaire, used to run PIMCO, big global bond house, moved over to Janus, and is the guru there, and pretty much has called a lot of the shots in the last 10, 15 years, and he's raising this big warning sign talking about, we've got a bond bubble. And as I've said before on this show and in my various works, a bond crisis is 10 times more important than the stock market crash. Bonds are huge, huge total bonds out there, government bonds and corporate bonds and quasi bonds and so forth. If we get a problem in the bond market, it's bar the door. You ain't seen nothing yet. Okay, so Bill says, Bill Gross here, interviewed this morning on Bloomberg, points out that we are in a recession in the U.S. except for consumer spending. That's the only thing that's holding up the U.S. economy. Real investment is declining significantly in the U.S., has declined significantly. Right? We are at roughly zero real investment growth, business investment growth. Construction, residential, commercial is stagnating. Productivity is down. As Bill says correctly, we have a structural unemployment problem. 10, 14 million people leaving the labor force, they should be considered unemployed, but they're not, you see. If you leave the labor force, you're not considered unemployed. Well, that clouds the whole job employment picture, the way they define unemployment in the U.S., if you don't have a job, you should be considered unemployed. Well, that's not the case. Right. Much more narrow definition of unemployment. Well, we've gone over that in the past, so I'm not going to go over that again, right? So why do we have this consumer spending going and everything else declining, retreating, slowing in the U.S. economy. Right. Well, according to Bill here, it's because we have this massive increase in consumer debt going on that's fueling it all. You see, if you segment the households, you got the top 5-10% maybe. Their spending is being driven by these huge capital gains in the stock and bond markets that they're doing so well with, right, and have been for 7 years now. Right, it's a significant group, but not the majority group of household spenders. The main group of household spenders are engaging in spending based on massive household debt increase going on once again. And if you look at some of the data, right, it's credit cards, it's mortgages, high-end homes, mortgages, it's autos, it's student loans, massive borrowing, and Medicare, medical expenses to some extent. Okay, what are the statistics for this? Well, credit cards lending by the banks is up $54 billion in the past year. Mortgage lending up $643 billion. Auto loans up $44 billion. And student loans, of course, up over $100 billion in 1 year. Well, you know, this is all debt-based. And all these billions actually get spent either by households or small businesses or whomever the household spend it on, buying houses and so forth, gets funneled back to households. So huge amount. Well, so why are the banks lending so much? Why are they pushing massive consumer debt? It's because the banks are getting squeezed, you see, by low rates. They can't make any profits on their margins because their rates are so low. And of course, that's a function of what the what's been done by the central banks, the Fed and so forth. They've kept the rates super, super low. Why have they done that? Because they have this false idea that if you pump money into capital assets, that huge increase in capital incomes will trickle out to spending on creating new businesses and new investment that create actual jobs and income. Well, it's not dribbling out anymore. As Bill Gross has said, monetary policy is, quote, weak and dying. We are in a deflationary world. The federal funds rate, the bank rate, must rise. You know, it's at incredibly low rates here. And he says it must rise, and he's right, because if it doesn't rise, we have a crisis brewing of major proportions going on in the pension funds and in insurance companies and in the banks. Financial institutions becoming much more fragile as a result of this monetary policy of low rates for so long by the Federal Reserve. Recently, past week, Metropolitan Life, profits down 94%. Their shares in 1 day dropped 10%. That's a warning bell. MetLife is the biggest insurance company in the U.S., maybe in the world, I don't know, right along there with AIG. Maybe even bigger, right? Pension funds are pleading with the government, you've got to raise rates because we can't stay in business. Well, we're going to have pension crisis. That, of course, will affect consumer household spending when it crashes. But the banks are being squeezed by this as well. So pension funds, insurance funds, and banks. The banks are responding by, you know, facing this lower profitability on margins. They're responding by trying to make it up in volume, which means they are pushing credit cards out there, pushing mortgages, mostly in the high end, and pushing auto loans. Auto loans, including massive subprime auto loans. And as we said last week, the auto industry has peaked and is leveling out and is about to decline. It's held up the real economy for the last 5 years with this big boom in auto sales. But it's been enabled by this very, very loose credit. You know, you can go out and buy a car with no interest, no down, and so forth. And people have been purchasing on that basis. And the banks and the auto companies go along with it, low credit financing. They're not making their money off of the interest and the financing of it, but they're raising the price of these cars. But because you can get in so easy, cars and trucks, by the way, so easy, you know, people are taking these loans. Long-term loans, they stretch them out. The average now for an auto loan is 6 years. That's the average, meaning there are people buying high-priced automobiles, average of which is over 30,000 now, buying high-priced automobiles at 8 and 10 years. Finance, well, the car's going to collapse before that comes, right? And they're going to owe that money, and there's going to be a reckoning somewhere down the road, you know, before the car is paid off. They're going to default on it. That's what's going to happen. They're going to say, I can't pay this bill anymore on this car that doesn't run anymore after 5-6 years. Here, take it. You know? So the auto companies and the banks are trying to save their skin today, and they're going to pay for it tomorrow, and we're going to see big defaults in auto loans coming because they are essentially subprime auto loans. Fastest growing part of the auto finance industry. So, you know, the point is credit cards, 50-60 billion increase in 1 year, mortgages, 600-700 billion, autos, 50 billion, 40-50 billion in 1 year, student loans, 150 billion. This is all debt driven consumption. And that's why consumer spending is the only thing that's above water right now. The rest of the economy is in a funk in the U.S., slowing. Not as bad as the U.K., of course, right? We know this whole Brexit thing, what it's done to the U.K. Inevitable. You know, the U.K. economy was already fragile. This vote simply just precipitated the push over the edge. All the global economies are fragile. And it doesn't take much, and it doesn't even need to be an economic thing. It can be a political thing of confidence affecting spending and or investment, and boom, there it goes. Contraction. Well, what's the response by the British capitalist here? Well, the Bank of England, you know, the equivalent of the U.S. Federal Reserve over there, the central bank, came out with a whopper here yesterday, a big stimulus package, monetary stimulus, more of the same. After 7-8 years, we're still dealing with monetary injections as the solution to a lack of recovery. In other words, monetary policy puts the money in the hands of financial investors, and the assumption is it's going to dribble down, and it doesn't, but it goes into stock and bond markets and makes investors rich, super rich, filthy rich. And that's what's happened. Okay, well, you know, in 2008-09, like the U.S., the U.K. engaged in QE. In other words, the central bank buying up bonds, injecting money into the economy from investors and institutions, you know, some like $600-700 billion equivalent of that. Well, they've just announced another QE here. They're going to buy another $70 billion of bonds, government bonds, but $10 billion of that's going to be corporate bonds. You see, when you buy up most of the government bonds out there, well, what else are you going to buy? Well, central banks start buying corporate bonds. And then, as in Japan, they start buying stocks. Central banks are gobbling up these securities all over in order to keep the prices up and keep the whole system from slipping back into another crisis. That's what the central banks are doing. But, as Bill Gross says, it's weak and dying. In other words, it's having less and less effect, so they have to pump more and more in to try to get the same kind of effect. And the effects are declining so much that it's almost impossible to get much of an effect from monetary policy anymore. Well, what is this Bank of England stimulus? Well, if you look at it, QE2, $70 billion, including $10 billion of corporate bond buying, and reducing the interest rate for the first time in the last 7 years to 0.25%, with the forecast that if the UK goes into recession, of course it's a recession, right? That they may reduce it even more. Oh, by the way, the UK BOE, Bank of England, forecast for this year is that there won't be a recession. It will be, the economy will be flat at 0.1% growth. Well, that's political, saying that. Of course it's going to be in recession. And next year, it's 2017, it will grow at 0.8%. I don't believe that either. The UK is in recession, not stagnation. And it will continue, because all this talk about what to do about Brexit is not going to be resolved next year. It's going to continue. They're going to drag this out as long as they can and hope that something happens that they don't have to exit. Public opinion changes. You know, they're letting the recession, you know, whack public confidence and public opinion over there. And they hope if they delay it long enough, after 2 years of recession, the British people are going to say, well, okay, you know, maybe we shouldn't leave. And there will be some sort of compromise that will sound like they're leaving, but they won't be leaving. You see, this is the game British capitalists are playing over there. All right. Now, there's a third element to this Bank of England stimulus. Well, we talked about the new QE2, $70 billion, and reducing rates to a quarter. But there's another element to it all, and that's called the Term Funding Scheme, TFS, in which £100 billion will have to be lent by the banks to households and to businesses. In other words, if the central bank, the Bank of England, is going to pump this money into them, they have to prove somehow that they're going to pass it on, not hoard it like the banks have done before. They've hoarded the money, central banks, passed the money into the private banking system. The private banks sit on it, they hoard it, or they invest it into financial assets, or they pass it on to shadow banks and other investors that invest in financial assets as well. Right? That's the process. Well, this TFS, Term Funding Scheme, is really designed theoretically to force the banks not to funnel it off, redirect it into financial assets, but to funnel it into real business spending and household spending. Well, we'll see if that works. But it's a recognition on their part that previous QE and injections have been redirected to the wrong place or hoarded. As I've been saying all along, and in fact, my chapter in my book, Systemic Fragility and Global Economy, published earlier this year, has an entire chapter on central bank follies, and how this money has, this liquidity injection, massive, historical, unprecedented liquidity injection, which has occurred, you know, in the post-1980 period, has benefited largely capital incomes and the rich financial asset markets, you see. Right? All of this injection now in the new version here in the Bank of England means that the 10-year gilt bond, as they call it, equivalent of 10-year Treasury bond over there in England is down to 0.63%. 0.63. And the BOE, Bank of England, holds half of all government bonds out there now. You know, then they recognize by buying $10 billion a year in corporate bonds that they're going to run out of the government bonds and they're going to have to buy corporate bonds. And then they, Bank of England, would do just what the European Central Bank and Japan Central Bank are doing. They'll start buying stocks. They're gobbling up all these assets to keep the price up, which means protecting their rich friends. Right? There are negative consequences to this this program in the BOE, Bank of England. You know. One thing is that you get further currency depreciation of the pound, which is kind of what they want, or some of them in the UK want, you know, to make their exports cheaper and allow them to better compete with other global capitalist sectors for the global trade. The problem is the global trade volume is slowing. It's stagnant. It's not growing. So they're all fighting over a shrinking pie. They, meaning all the central banks on behalf of their financial systems and financial investors, they're fighting over a shrinking pie by depreciating their currency. But this is all part of, you know, spreading currency wars. The central banks are behind all this, and they're doing this quid pro quo. I'm going to drive my currency down, you drive yours, and you drive yours, you know, and it's just, you know, this for that, and everybody follows each other in a downward spiral. And that's why the European Central Bank and the Bank of Japan have been sitting off, watching and waiting to what the Bank of England does. Okay, now it's the depreciated currency. So now they're going to have to do it, too. They're going to have to take another round, especially Japan, which we'll talk about shortly. Right. They will do the same thing. So more inflation will be the result, because if you reduce your currency, imported goods will go up in price. More inflation means less consumer spending, declining real incomes. Real incomes in the UK decline even more for workers as unemployment rises. And as the housing price situation deflates, which was already in a bubble, and now it's deflating property prices rapidly over there. So deflating prices and slowing real consumption means business investment, already slowing, will slow even more. Right? And we have a growing problem in pension funds and insurance companies over there, just like in the U.S. and everywhere else, because they make their money based on the spread, interest rate spread. And there's no spread, you see. Interest rates are just low. And that kind of forces pension funds to take big risks to try to get their yield up, their rate of return up, so that they can continue paying pensions, you know. And most of these pension models are based on assumptions of 5 to 8% interest rate growth. Well, you've got 2% and less interest rate growth. They're getting squeezed. The Federal Reserve is screwing people on retirement pensions. They've been screwing us for 8 years now with zero rates on fixed income returns, and they're going to screw us even more by destroying our pension funds, which are just, you know, on the brink. Oh, but in doing that, oh, you know, they reward their financial investors. You know, corporations and banks love this. Low rates. The corporations just, you know, issue new bonds, new corporate bonds, because it doesn't cost them hardly anything. And then they take the money from issuing these bonds, massive investment grade and junk bond issuance. What do they do with that? Well, they either sit on it or they buy back their stock, drive up the price of their stock, and reward their stockholders, which are mostly their, you know, big friends, own the big chunks of the stock, big investors. Or they pay out more dividends. In other words, they pass on the wealth that's been created by financial speculation, financial asset prices rising, which in turn has been enabled by this massive central bank injections that have driven down interest rates. See, it's all connected. The government policy, the Fed driving down rates, capital asset prices escalating, corporate, big corporations and bankers and so forth making a big windfall killing, and then passing it on in stock buybacks and dividend cuts, dividend payment increases to their big stockholders, or they sit on the rest, you know. I mean, look at Apple sitting on $100 billion plus, all these big tech companies and pharmaceutical companies and others, you know, are just sitting on wads and wads of cash that they should be using to invest. Well, what are the pharmaceutical companies? They're using it to buy up their competitors and move their headquarters to Ireland and other places in Europe, inversions where they don't have to pay Uncle Sam any taxes, you see. Or health insurance companies, Aetna, right? And the others, buying each other up so that they can jack up the prices of health insurance next year. Already starting to escalate. You know. And antitrust action isn't going to stop that. It's a rear guard government, tepid, token response to this concentration of these health insurance companies who are putting pressure on the government, saying, oh, we can't survive under the Obamacare Act. You know, we're going to have to raise our prices. And Obama is on the way out. He doesn't care. He's not doing anything about it, leaving it for the next president, whoever that is. So watch out. Here comes the health insurance price gouging again. And the drug companies already gouging us. You know? Have you tried to get Medicare Part D or Part B coverage? No. Prices are going through the roof, and they're going to continue to go through the roof. ACA, you know, Obamacare insurance prices next year, up to go. Same time, rents are going up. You know, same time, other costs are going up, and real incomes are going down, especially for those 50 million or so retirees. They're catching it from both ends. You see, in the U.S., it's the old people, retirees, who are catching it, and it's the very young people who are catching the burden of what's wrong here. They can't get jobs, or they can't get decent-paying jobs. They can't get jobs that they can start families and live on their own. You know? Oh, but the U.S. economy is doing great. Yeah, they say it's doing fine. You know, it's growing here 2%, which is about two-thirds of its normal growth. But that's okay. It's growing fine. Wages are rising, they say. Yeah. I don't believe that one either, at least not for the bottom 80% of the workforce. You know, you may have significant increases in the top 10, 20%, which skew the averages up. I don't believe anything that's an average anymore. Show me the median, not the average, not the mean. Okay, and if you look at returning to Bank of England, right, all this negative stuff we talked about, unemployment rising, housing deflation, business investment declining, real incomes declining, emerging pension crisis over there now. Oh, but the big surge in stock prices in the announcement of this latest Bank of England response. Right? Bank of England's following the same path that Japan has been following, more and more QE. Bank of Japan, you know, is Abe, Shinzo Abe, their prime minister here, you know, he had this thing called Abenomics. Oh, you know, we're going to, what is Abenomics? You know, it's three things. It's monetary stimulus, massive, Bank of Japan, central bank monetary stimulus, massive, as a proportion of their economy greater than the U.S., has done. Okay, more QE, in other words, not just buying government bonds, which they bought up most of, but corporate bonds and stocks. Yeah, the central bank's buying up everything. And once again, when the central bank buys up, In other words, it prints money and it uses it, you know, to purchase these securities, these assets, stocks, bonds, and so forth. So money goes into the economy in Japan, but as in other places, that money that's been pumped into Japan's economy goes either into financial assets, or, in the case of Japan, it flows right out of the country and it's used to in Japanese corporations to invest and expand offshore. You know, they're doing a lot of investment offshore, but they're not doing much in Japan itself. As a result, wages have been declining. Okay, so the first element, they call it the arrow of Abenomics, three arrows, right, is this monetary injection, which has been massive. The second arrow was supposed to be fiscal, you know, fiscal stimulus. Well, they started out their fiscal stimulus by raising their sales tax, which threw their economy a year or so ago back into a recession, the fifth since 2008. Well, now they've just announced, well, a few months ago, oh, the second sales tax increase schedule for next year is going to be suspended. So they're smart enough to realize that, you know, in an economy where people's incomes aren't rising and wages aren't rising, they're going down, which is Japan, right? When you raise taxes, sales taxes on households, they're going to spend even less. And there goes your economy again, even further, right? That's this thing about austerity being the flip side of this free money injection policy that all the capitalist central banks, capitalist economies, advanced economies have been pursuing since 2008 as a solution. Put as much money as you can in the hands of investors, and maybe a little trickle down to create real jobs and real things. But as we said, not much trickle down even from the beginning, and now it's barely a drip. As Bill Gross says, it's weak and dying monetary policy. Okay, so, but you could read the suspension of this value-added second sales tax increase in Japan as a prelude to an actual fiscal stimulus. As I said last week, I think it's been such a failure, the monetary policy. Well, it hasn't been a failure, you know, global central banks and monetary policy hasn't been a failure for the rich and the investors. It's been an incredible success for them. It's been a failure in terms of bringing around the rest of the economy. That's where it's been a failure. So you always got to say, failure for whom here? Not for the rich. It works. It works fine. They love it. And, of course, since they have so much influence in the political system, they just keep it going. Well, now it's beginning to have negative impact on even some of the rich, you know, pension funds, insurance companies, banks, and so forth. So now they're having second thoughts. Oh, well, maybe we have to do something because, if, as Bill Gross says, if you keep these interest rates so low, you're going to have an implosion in certain sectors of the financial system. And that's what's got them worried right now. So now they're saying, well, okay, maybe we got to raise interest rates a little bit to prevent the collapse of, you know, pensions and banks and insurance companies. That's a certain segment of their experts are beginning to discuss that question. That means they are about to abandon austerity, fiscal austerity. But they won't do it significantly. If they do it, they won't do it significantly. In other words, they'll put a toe in the water and they'll have a little fiscal stimulus and it won't be very much. But at least it won't be austerity anymore. Well, why are they going to do the fiscal stimulus? Because they got to raise interest rates, you see, to prevent further collapse of certain sectors of the financial system. They got to raise rates. Raising rates is going to slow the economy. It's certainly going to have a big negative impact on housing and commercial property, which is very sensitive interest rates, and, you know, it means that sector is going to decline sharply. Okay, so you've got to offset that decline with some sort of expansionary stimulus on the fiscal side. And that's what they're thinking about right now. And this will happen after the election. You see, all these countries' central banks are looking at the U.S., and the U.S. is sort of marking time, and they're waiting for the elections, U.S. elections over, because then you're going to see a big shift. And they will follow the U.S. They cannot, Europe, Japan, right, UK, they cannot move dramatically contrary to what the U.S. is going to do, U.S. interest rates, U.S. fiscal policy. They are watching it. They're all watching each other, you know. They're all sitting and looking at each other, you know, Japan central banks and policymakers in the U.K. and in Europe, ECB. They're all looking, in the U.S., they're all looking at each other. You know, you go first. Now you go first. And they're all, oh, you increased QE and lowered your currency and stimulated your exports, so I got to do it too. I can't let you steal my declining export share already. So, you know, Japan responds, and they all watch each other, and they're all watching the Fed. And the Fed's on hold because of the election. And because of the realization by the Fed that the U.S. economy is not all that robust. No matter what the spin is in the press, everything is flashing red in the U.S. economy, you know, except consumption and, you know, the statistical volatility in the job markets. That's not enough for them to robustly raise interest rates. So the Fed has been prevaricating. But after the election, I predict there will be move. There will be move to fiscal stimulus. That fiscal stimulus will be long-term infrastructure spending, and not very much, but it will be some. But that will not be enough. If they also raise rates when they engage in this fiscal, modest fiscal stimulus, I don't think it will have a positive effect on the economy. I think, nonetheless, the economy will contract because of this. Let me put it in economics terms, right? The multiplier effect from fiscal stimulus has declined. In other words, they don't get as much bang from the buck from fiscal stimulus as they used to. They think they will, but they won't. At the same time, the sensitivity to a rise in interest rates, of investment to a rise in interest rates, is very, very sensitive. Fiscal side, multipliers, not very sensitive, does not respond. Interest rate responds very quickly and very abruptly to rises in interest rates. It will take a very significant increase in fiscal stimulus to offset the contractionary effects of an increase in interest rates, you see. And I don't think they're going to be smart enough to do that, because most of mainstream economics still functions on the basis of assumptions of fiscal multipliers that are no longer work. At the same time, they function on the basis of sensitivity of interest rates to investment that no longer prevails. I go into this in great detail in my book, Systemic Fragility. You know, what's wrong with mainstream economics and their assumptions? They're still looking at an economy of decades ago, and they don't understand how it's been financialized and globalized financially, which has affected their interest rate sensitivities and their fiscal multipliers. And they're still using old models, old multipliers, and old assumptions about interest rate effects on investment in the economy, because they don't understand finance. They don't understand how the global capitalist economy has been financialized here in the 21st century, which has upended all their models. Okay, enough for mainstream economics. Back to Japan. Okay, we got Abenomics, three arrows, massive fiscal stimulus still going on, all right? We have a shift that's pending on the fiscal side, fiscal stimulus. Japan hasn't really gone into the fiscal stimulus because it's afraid that if it does, others won't follow, and it will be at a disadvantage as a result. What's that disadvantage? They're worried that a fiscal stimulus will drive up the value of their currency, which is already rising, you see, cutting off their exports and export share. So they wanted to do this, but only if the rest of the advanced economies do it. And that's why Abe Shinzo, in the recent G20 meeting in Asia, pleaded with the rest of the advanced economies, you know, please stimulate your economy so we can do that with ours. We can't do it ourselves without putting ourselves at a disadvantage. Please. And as Abe even said, we are approaching a Lehman moment, quote, Lehman moment, meaning Lehman Brothers collapse, financial collapse, a financial crisis. Yeah, that's what he said to them. And they ignored it, of course. Oh, no, we're not at a Lehman moment yet. We can continue the free money show for everybody who wants to invest for a while yet. They're like trying to time the market, which means they will wait until there is a crisis before they do anything, and then they won't do enough, and the crisis will get worse, just like 2008-09, that whole process. Then they'll try to get ahead of the curve. Okay, the big problem over in Japan is that their currency is drifting upward. By the way, that's the only reason why China has not pushed the further devaluation of its currency, the yuan, because one of its big competitors over there in Asian markets, the Japanese, their currency is rising, which means that the Chinese yuan is, in effect, declining in relationship to the yen, and therefore they don't have to devalue the yuan further in relationship to other currencies than the dollar. Not yet. It's at the extreme of its band of flexibility there, but what is it, 6.768 to the dollar, 6.7, 6.8 to the dollar. You know, right at the edge, more devaluations coming if it happens. But, the pressure's off because the yen has risen. Mm-hmm. Okay, but now, you got the pound falling further and the euro falling further as a result of the Italian banking crisis, which we started to talk about last week, which, by the way, is spreading now. It's not an Italian banking crisis anymore. It's a Euro banking crisis. And these phony stress tests, banking stress tests, trying to cover it up over there. And it includes German banks. And the German economy slowing dramatically as a result of concern over German banks. So we have Italian banking crisis, $400 billion non-performing loans, driving down bank stock prices everywhere in Europe, including in Germany and the Northern Core. And on top of that, we got Brexit, which is driving down UK bank stock prices. So Europe, we've got these, it's in a vice, it's in a banking vice, Problems with the UK banks, Barclays down, 40%? Stock price decline, 40%? Barclays, I think it was, 43%, right? Deutsche Bank, down 30-40%. Credit Suisse, down 26%. Okay, these stock prices are an indication of deeper problems in the banking system. When investors see these problems in the banking system, they sell their stock, their bank stocks. And that's exactly what's happening in Europe. So this crisis in Italian banks, overlaid with the Brexit situation and, pressures on the British banks, RBS, Royal Bank of Scotland, as well as Barclays, two big problem areas. In Germany, not only Deutsche Bank, but the big Commerzbank, right? And in Italy, of course, you know, we hear about this Monte dei Paschi or something, oldest bank in Europe, one of the largest banks in Italy, in deep, deep trouble, trying to arrange a bailout of private money, which won't work. Unicredit, the other big Italian, biggest Italian bank, in trouble as well. So we have a spreading problem of banking instability in Europe. In Germany, you know, the problem is not so much non-performing loans, which is a problem in places like Italy, you know, Portugal, Greece, and so forth. That's the problem there. But in Germany, it's just lack of profitability because the rates are so low. The central bank has driven the rates to so low, it's put a squeeze on these banks. And, you know, at the same time, the banks got to, because they're in trouble, they're being required by regulators to hold more capital, credit, you know, buffers, right? That means they can't lend that out. So they're in trouble, right? They're getting squeezed. I mean, they're not in a crisis situation, but they're being squeezed. And when banks get squeezed, they don't lend, right? Or as in the U.S., what they're doing is increasing the volume of their lending, even though the profitability, the margin rate of their lending, from their lending has declined, is shrinking. So they just increase in volume. You know, if you can't raise your price in business and increase your profits by raising price, you try to increase your volume of sales. And that's what the U.S. Banks are doing. European banks are far behind U.S. banks in terms of being able to deal with the global economy. U.S. banks take bigger risks and so forth, and crashes come, they come down big time. But the European banking system, for a number of reasons, is still 30 years behind. Okay, so the second arrow of Abe, right? Second arrow of Abe is fiscal policy, but he can't get it going. He can't quite get it going because the rest won't follow suit yet. Mm-hmm. So we got this first arrow, more and more QE. Second arrow, fiscal is sort of still up in the air. And it looks to me like Abe and the Japanese capitalists are looking to maybe generating fiscal spending by remilitarizing. Yeah, Japan, is pushing, wants to engage in more military spending. But they're being held back by the U.S. That calls a lot of shots in Japan still. And the U.S. Concerned more of its relationship with China and Korea. So it's held Abe back, but, you know, it can't hold him back forever. If the crisis gets even worse in Japan, they will make that change towards more fiscal spending, but they got to change the Japanese constitution, more military fiscal spending. Well, you know, recently Abe won a big new landslide election there, because the other political party is just totally inept. And there's only one party there, pretty much. So he won a big landslide. And then he went and appointed this Tomimi Inada as defense minister, who's a big hawk and wants to remilitarize. So I think that what Abe has in his back pocket is, okay, if the rest of the world does not want to move towards fiscal spending, a fiscal stimulus, my second arrow, then I'm going to do it with military fiscal spending. We'll see how that happens. There's yet another option here in terms of fiscal stimulus, and that's called helicopter money. Well, what is helicopter money? You know, they're talking about it more in Japan, and they're talking about it now in England, and it's even being raised here. what do we mean by helicopter money, and how does it relate to all this discussion of the failure of monetary policy and the shift towards some kind of fiscal policy? And as we know, Japan is desperate to shift to some kind of fiscal policy, you know, either military spending or some kind of general fiscal policy, but that it can't engage in competitively, you know. Helicopter money relates to this statement of early in the 2000 decade by Milton Friedman, who was a guru of monetarists, who said that embraced thereafter by his protege Ben Bernanke, who kissed his butt theoretically to get appointed to the Fed as Fed chair under Bush. Okay, both believe, and both, you know, both Friedman and Bernanke had talked a decade ago about helicopter money. In other words, if there was a crisis and they couldn't get the economy going again, that the government would just provide income to stimulate consumption to get it going. You know, if the wages were falling and incomes were falling and people weren't able to buy things because of it and there was massive unemployment, right, give the people money, spending, and that spending would generate, you know, consumption, and that would then stimulate investment. You know, as people were able to buy goods, businesses would invest more, would hire more people. People would have more income, more wages. They'd buy more goods, and we'd have a virtuous upward spiral, you see. So what was helicopter money? Helicopter money is this. This is what helicopter money is in essence. It's QE for Main Street. What do we mean by that? Well, it means that the central bank, let's use the Fed in this case, the central bank will print money, that's what QE is, and will buy bonds from the U.S. government. The U.S. government will create bonds and sell them to the central bank. The central bank will give the U.S. government the money, the real money, which the central the government, you know, Congress, president, the government will then spend. Actually, it would bypass Congress. The government will then spend by injecting the money into the economy, into whatever sector of the economy, give money to people, buy things from people, give a big $1,000 check to every household, or, you know, pump the money into investment, government investment, you know, alternative energy or whatever, but get the money out there into the economy. Now, that's quite different than the present arrangement in which the government, right, has to create bonds that the Federal Reserve simply sells for the U.S. Treasury bonds, into investors, right? Give them bonds, they buy the bonds, the money comes into the Fed, it goes to the Treasury and so forth, and that incurs a debt. You see, when the U.S. Treasury issues bonds that way and sells the bonds to the public, or foreigners, own half of the Treasury bonds, when it does that, it incurs the debt. In other words, when you sell Treasury bonds to the public, the government has a debt. It doesn't work that way when you just sell bonds to the central bank, which is technically part of the government, you see. It doesn't get registered as a debt on the national debt. So now they're talking about helicopter money in that sense. You know, then the government would, quote, drop it as helicopters, you know, free money, all this money, you know, helicopter money. Friedman talked about $1,000 bills, right? That's what helicopter money is in essence. Bank creating money, printing money, selling it, or the federal government, U.S. government, buying that money. As the Fed buys the Treasury bonds, right, and the government has the money and it puts it into the, spends it into the economy. It's a kind of fiscal stimulus, isn't it? Yes. That's what it is. But it's a stimulus that stimulates from the bottom up instead of the old QE, which gives it to the rich people and investors on the top and hope it trickles down. This way it goes in through the bottom. Well, Bernanke and both Paul Krugman visited with Japan here recently talking about this. By the way, I've made this proposal as well to Jill Stein, and a candidate for president of the U.S., Green Party candidate. You know, which she's concerned, how do we get rid of this student debt, $1.3 trillion, that's overburdening millions of people? People are defaulting, 16-17% default on student debt because they have no jobs, or they have poor-paying jobs, right? How do we get rid of this student debt? Well, as I said to Jill, and I'll be writing about this some more on my blog, jackrasmus.com, what you can do is helicopter money. In other words, have the Fed print the money. The government will sell their bonds to the Fed. They'll get the money. And then what the government does is buy up the stream of income, student debt payments for those who have been making their payments. In other words, not to those who are in default. I need another solution for that. So they can't argue that you're encouraging people to default, right? You're paying them when they default. For the millions of people that still have debt, have the government simply pay the Department of Education the monthly payments of those people who are making payments, you know, $800,000 a month, to the federal government, because the federal government owns most of these student loans. That would not add to the government deficit and debt at all, because you're just moving money around within the government. You know, money's created by the central bank, goes to the government. The government sends the money to the Department of Education. But what it does is it frees up all these student households, all these households with student debt, many of them, you know, are working, to spend the additional money on the real economy, to stimulate consumption based on real income availability. Free up that income and let them spend it. In fact, you could figure out ways that you can tie the debt relief, we're going to pay your debt monthly to monthly, you have to spend it in some other way. Right? Maybe part of it you could require them to purchase Obamacare health insurance, or help, you know, offset the purchase of Obamacare health insurance. Something like that. That's helicopter money. That's what that is. That's QE for Main Street. Doesn't add to debt. Allows the government to inject real income and money into the economy and relieve this huge household debt burden, which, as we start out in the beginning of the show, has been rising so dramatically and the only thing keeping the economy going. Okay, that's helicopter money, and that's our tour of the global economy. And next week, we'll talk some more. I want to get back into this thing of the European banking crisis now being contagious. Jack Rasmus, Alternative Visions.